has 368 rooms. That's not bad.
That's nothing.
I mean,
how they can sell this book for 100 rupees, I don't understand. Because you can't even get any more 100 pages for 100 rupees, so it's quite a bargain. And so I'm sure that it will take us a few days, 2 or 3 days, to get through one chapter. Basically, what I want to go over is pages 324 to 342, but not everything.
So, could you tell us when you think next week we will need to collect the poems and then we'll be...
Okay. Yes, I can do that. And we don't have to carry so many books.
That was to 340.
342. I mean, I don't mean to say that there's not more which is worth reading, but
of course.
The essential things are here. And the purpose of these few sessions will be to further the general aim known philosophically as the final cause of being able to read Sri Aurobindo's poetry, especially Savitri, to read it orally.
Yeah, every morning I read.
But,
yes.
But,
half an hour in French.
That doesn't count.
Every day, half an hour in French.
This course, that doesn't
maybe
count.
Not just I tell you, but in French, not in English.
Right. Mm. So, don't you want to sit in front of this instead of behind me?
Yeah, this is closer to me.
So, we're going to learn the basics of English metrics. And Sri Aurobindo has given very clear, very simple, very direct indications. But unless you're familiar with the subject, even reading his definitions and his examples might not make a very strong impression on you. If you have read a great deal of English poetry, then this will make an impression on you, just reading it. But how many people today have read a great deal of English poetry? Who here has read, for example, the major part of Shelley's poetry?
You better ask who here didn't read Shelley.
So, Sri Aurobindo read the major part of Shelley's poetry, and also the major part of Wordsworth's poetry, and Keats's poetry, and Byron's poetry, and so on, all the way up to, there are a few pages here on the poetry of T.S. Eliot. So, and as I said, this essay that we're reading on quantitative meter was written in 42. So, in 1942, Sri Aurobindo was the master poet. He was well into the writing of Savitri and Ilium. He was not fooling around anymore with lyrics. He was writing very serious poetry, as we know. Savitri has an intention which can only be communicated through poetry. Otherwise, he would have been happy to stay with the life divine. and the translations of the Upanishads. So he knew that something else was needed, and we read this last time from this book. He knew that a poetry was needed for the evolution, but as a bridge between the ordinary mentality and the higher mind, before the overmind could descend. So this is the large structure. And so at some point here, when in our reading, we will understand very well what Sri Aurobindo means by overmind inspiration coming through poetry. That would be one of our long-term goals. And in order to know that, we must be able to hear it. Now, it is possible to get a direct descent from the reading of and listening to the poetry without knowing what we're going to learn. But that's that's a boon. That's a grace which is given to those who happen to be in the presence of that invocation at that moment. But to use that tool, that gift, continually for transformation is the real point. That's why you read it every morning. So then the question is, how to do that most effectively? And Sri Aurobindo explains in great detail that there is a certain aspect of that poetry which is essential. And the eye doesn't get it. The ear gets it. And it's rhythm. That's it. And that rhythm only comes through a kind of energetic transmission. And it builds up. The rhythm builds up. And as the rhythm builds up, the images become clearer. And as the images become clearer, your mind begins to be resonant with that plane of vision. So then, the sound and the sight become simultaneous. And as that sound and sight build, that energy flows in. That stillness, that vastness, that universality, and also that vibration in the being. And that's really what it is. So, to get to that point, we start with very small baby steps today, like this. Aurelio, did you want to ask a question?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you how you define English matrix in contrast to German or French or Sanskrit matrix. Is there something which you can say matrix is common to all languages, the principles of matrix, and then according to the grammar and language, it differentiates itself?
That's a good question for you to answer for us.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, here there is a regular iambic beat determined by the persistent, accentual, high pitch or low pitch falling on the second syllable of the foot. Now, if you read this with your eye, and you read that with your eye, you might not hear anything. Try it. Just read these two lines silently and those three lines and see what you hear.
It's impossible to read with the eye without hearing.
Yeah, you can hear it.
You can hear it.
The beats in here.
And Sri Aurobindo has kindly marked the beat for us.
Yeah.
But eventually, this is not something that you will do consciously. You will simply know when you read the line where the accent and where the stress and where the quantity, the weight, lies. And it's the weight, as he will explain in a moment, which is really essential. But here he's beginning on a very simple level. The way was long, the wind was cold, the minstrel was infirm and old. Don't do that.
Okay.
No, it's not that kind of rhythm.
It's checking whether it was or not. I was sure.
Because we were taught that in school. Da 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 da. That's iambic. Da 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 da. That's dactylic. And 1, 2, 3, 4 is 4 beats to the measure. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2 is 2 beats to the measure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is 8 beats to the measure. So you can ingrain in your mind these standard rhythms, but Sri Aurobindo will tell you at some point that that kind of artificial imposition on the line of poetry doesn't work. It doesn't really give you a true reading. You tend to start looking for those patterns and you tend to impose those patterns on what you're reading. So what we're going to survey tonight is a variety of metric structures. See that there. We're going to look at spandhi. Okay. Spandhi is two longs. Trochee is a long and a short. Iamb is a short and a long. These are common, similar feet or metric measurements, accents. Then we will look at dactyl, which is a long and two shorts. And we will look at anapest, which is two shorts and a long. And anapest and dactyl are used, well, all of these are used all of the time in Sri Aurobindo's poetry, but in hexameter, these are extremely common, as we will start to hear. Then there is, corresponding to spandhi, there is something called Pyrrhic. Actually, there's an H there. Like a flame.
Too short.
And then we have a Bacchius. This one is the delightful one. Short and two longs. And then we have something that Sri Aurobindo calls the anti-Bacchius. Guess what that is?
Long and a short.
Good. And then we have something called an amphibrach. And that is like that. So the I am, the way was long, the wind was cold, the minstrel was infirm and old. Very regular iambic meter. The instance given is an example of the iambic verse with an extreme and almost mechanical regularity of beat. So, for completeness, we may turn to poetry of a freer and larger type. That's from me. Oh, you mean these poems?
Sometimes
he tells you who they're from, and sometimes he makes them up. Okay. And he doesn't tell you always which it is.
Just curious.
The most interesting ones he does give a tribute.
He tells
to someone.
Shelley or Whitman.
Or himself.
Or himself. Yeah.
But right now, he's just giving examples, and I think he probably took them from somewhere. But here there are two glide anapests in the first line, an initial dactyl in the second, three departures from the regular iambic. Does he say next?
Feet is the next word.
No, it's 50 pages. Okay, 1 second.
So we have to go this way?
No, I will do.
Yeah.
Okay. I could make it 1 page.
Three departures from the iambic beat. Such liberty of variation can always be indulged in English verse, and is sometimes pushed to much greater lengths, that is to say, the liberty. So we will see a lot of considerable greater examples of greater liberty than this. But for now, this is a nice description. He tells you exactly what it is, and he marks it. Who would like to read this? Full many a glorious morning have I seen flattering the mountain tops with sovereign eye.
It seems I'm not sure, but on auxiliary verbs, this will be.
So, what you will notice is, the way I read it, I didn't try to emphasize anything. I just read the lines. But if you listen, And if you watch the markings, you will see that it's a very subtle but very precise meter. Full many a glorious morning have I seen, flattering the mountain tops with sovereign eye. Now you could become a fourth grade prosody student and say, full many a glorious morning have I seen, flattering the mountain tops with sovereign eye, and then it would be total bullshit. So, it's very subtle, this poetic meter, and it's very natural. And normally, a poet will not even think about it. Because you, after writing poetry for a while, you become unconsciously completely familiar with all of these. And you just know spontaneously which ones fit together and which ones don't. And your ear is always telling you when you're writing poetry whether it works or not.
I think there's actually two, as I remember doing those exercises, there's a two-step process. The first one is that you, it's fairly easy for everybody to see where the emphasis is at. But to decide where you make the, where you divide the meters, that's a different...
You don't decide. Huh? You don't decide, you can't decide, you shouldn't decide. The meaning of rhythm in poetry is that it is natural. Okay? It's natural. And Sri Aurobindo complains in this essay that poets use a couple of principles, accent and stress, and sometimes try to write quantitative hexameter, for example, using these principles, and it's a complete failure. And he says what the English poets haven't fully recognized is that quantity is natural to the language. And so there are many examples of that, and we will learn what he means by quantity. If we go...
Can you say, for instance, in both lines there was a differentiation between the full stress and the half stress, like the lines which are going on the other side, or on the other line, half, for instance. It's like a weaker stress, or...?
There is weaker stress and harder stress, yeah. And there are all kinds of subtle differences, but they're not measured.
Mm-hmm. What is the measure again?
A measure is a foot. This is a poetic foot. This is one, this is one, this is one, this is one. These are the limited, finite number of possible combinations of sound in English poetry. If you put together three syllables, or four syllables, or five syllables, and you say them all the different possible ways, these will be the ways that you say them.
So these feet are either two or three long.
No,
are there four?
No. If you have a poetic foot like this, get lost, you dog.
That's too
get funny. Lost. Where is the
okay.
new dog?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's 2 feet long.
So that's 2 feet long. 4 syllables, 2 feet.
Yeah.
So
3 syllables, 1 foot. 2 syllables, 1 foot.
Okay. Just...
4 syllables, 2 feet. 5 syllables, 2 feet.
Okay.
Yes.
Talking about the nature of the English language. I made a comment because I really don't know. Would auxiliary verbs almost invariably be weak? Take, have no stress.
You come back next week and tell us. And you think of you think of every auxiliary verb structure phrase. You read a book, mark every auxiliary phrase in the book, and then tell us what you decide about that.
Okay. I take that as a task.
Yeah, do that. Enjoy. Enjoy. Okay. Sri Aurobindo is saying that such liberties of variation, like that one that we just heard, are common. As in this line. Now, I really want somebody, without worrying about anything else, just to read that line cold right now. Kirti, would you do it?
Yeah. Cover her face, my eyes dazzle. She dazzled.
Cover her face. My eyes dazzle. She died young. Now, a school child might read it. Cover her face. My eyes dazzle. She died young. So Sri Aurobindo says, where there is only one I am in the 5 feet of the lion, the other 4 feet are respectively a trochee, a bacchus, a pyrrhic, and a closing spondee. Nevertheless, the basic system of the meter, or at least some form of its spirit, asserts itself even here by a predominant beat on the final syllable. Here, this is where he's commenting on this one. This is from Webster, this line. The famous dictionary guy. In Webster's line, this forceful irregularity is used with a remarkable skill and freedom. The two first feet are combined in a choriamb. A choriamb is a combination of an iambic foot and a trochee. It's just this and then it's reverse. So it's like a chorus. Cover her face. Cover her face. Cover her face. So the first syllable and the last syllable get accent, and the two middle syllables are short. That's called a choriamb. It's just a complex iambic foot. To bring out a vehemence of a swift and abrupt, unexpressed emotion. Cover her face. It's an emotion. In the rest, intrinsic quantitative longs combine with short vowel stress lengths to embody a surcharged feeling, still unexpressed, in a strong and burdened movement. So he comments further on this I think it's good if you just read the rest of his comment. Okay. finished?
Can you please step a little bit
more?
Can I
go down too far?
No, I don't mean. I'm looking to you.
You want me to?
I think it's possibly important to discern between longs and shorts and stressed and unstressed. And I don't know what Shravini says, but because you can have a long syllable which can be unstressed.
Yeah.
Or you can have a short one which is stressed.
Right. So if you can be patient about that, you'll say it quite a bit. A very short sound can be made to bear the weight of the whole foot, while longer ones trail after it in dependence on their diminutive leader. What we really have is a system of recurrent strokes or beats intervening at a fixed place in each foot, while the syllables which are not hammered into prominent place by this kind of stroke or beat, fill the interspaces. So I want to go down to another point where he speaks about this same poem on page 328.
What's a scansion?
It is looking over a line or some lines to find out the pattern. Okay, this is something that you were asking about, so let's see if we can put this together. Can you just make one page out of this?
Like this? I need to make one reading one.
Just have one. Which scrolls down from one page to the other.
Let me see.
I think if you put it in 100.
Yeah. What do you want? 129.
Yeah.
This one.
Right. Thank you.
Can I make it bigger? Sorry.
Okay, now on 325, let's go back up to 325. Okay. I wanted to show you something about Webster's line here. He says, in Webster's line, this forceful irregularity is used with a remarkable skill and freedom. So we read that. The language used, however vivid in itself, could not have done as much as it does if it were deprived of this sound effect. It would have given the idea by its external indices. But it is the rhythm that brings out the concealed feeling. Each word group has a separate rhythm, an independent life. Yet it is by following each other rapidly in a single whole that the three together achieve a complete force and beauty. If the three clauses of this line were cut up into successive lines, in modern free verse fashion, they would lose most of their beauty. It is the total rhythmic power of these three hammer strokes that brings to the surface all that underlies the words. Now let's go back up to the poem itself. And ask ourselves, what are the three word groups that Sri Aurobindo is speaking about? The three hammer strokes that put all of these together. It's not divided up into four or five. Cover her face. My eyes dazzle. She died young. So there are three weighted feet. There are one, two, three, four, five scannable feet, iambic and Trochi, okay, cover her face, that's a koryam. My eyes dazzle, this is short and too long.
He lists it right there, the 4 feet are respectively a trochi,
yeah. 4 feet are a trochi, a bakias, a pyrrhic, and a closing spondy, died young. And Sri Aurobindo uses this in his poetry quite frequently, this closing spondy. And he means for both of those words to get equal force. So when you scan this line, not according to the principle of accent, but according to the principle of weight, you get three poetic feet, quantitative feet. And this is the principle that Sri Aurobindo identifies as quantity in English verse. So his writing is based upon the principle of quantity. It is not based upon the principle of stress and accent. Stress and accent are always there, but they underlie the principle of quantity, which is the opposite of most English poetry. Most English poetry is not sung. Sri Aurobindo is a singer. He's a musician of words. His music is more important to him than his words and his statements. The words and the statements are carried by the music. That's the principle. Okay, so let's look at the one in between. Let's see what he says about this.
Can I ask for another?
Yeah.
What makes the quantitative quality? What's the difference in
weight?
I just want to ask between stress, accent, and weight, how you differentiate?
By listening. The only way to differentiate. Mm-hmm. Just keep listening. You'll hear it.
What's the difference between stress and accent?
Stress is when you raise your voice, and accent is like every word has one end or the other is accented. You know, in Espanol, the accent comes on the last syllable. In English, it comes on the first syllable, usually. So accent is inherent in language. Stress is inherent in language. And quantity is inherent in language. In English, we have learned to scan poetry for accent, stress, and imagery. But we haven't learned to scan poetry for quantity, normally. And a few poets have used it effectively. Shakespeare uses it sometimes, and Shelley uses it sometimes quite effectively. But mostly that's not the principle which is used. So here's an example. It will be seen that inherent quantity, it's not artificial. And Sri Aurobindo says this again and again and again. It is not artificial. You can't create it. You can create artificially stress and accent lines, but not quantity. It's inherent in the language, and in all languages. So, the inherent quantity combined with distribution of stress, which is also, as we shall see, a true quantity builder, stress builds quantity, plays always the same role, inherent quantity, to give variety, subtlety, deeper significance. That's what quantity does. It's like the rasa, the essence is in the quantity. A longer quotation may illustrate this position and function of stress distribution and distribution of quantity in accentual meter. So here we have accentual meter, an example where quantity can be heard. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven, and as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Now, let's see if we can hear where the weight is. The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. Where's the quantity there? Where are the quantitative breaks? The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. Three quantitative feet. Where is the accent? The lunatic, the lover, and the poet. Are of imagination all compact. Accent, compact. Compact, short, long. Are of imagination. Imagination has pretty equal stress distribution. There are accents, but there is not any stress there. Imagination has three stresses. Imagination. Imagination. There's a little bit more of an accent on the first syllable, which is not imaginación, because it's not Spanish. So, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. Imagination all compact. Imagination all compact. You can read it like that. Imagination all compact. That is an accentual foot. You can scan it like that, but you don't read it like that, and you don't write it like that. So if you're scanning poetry and you don't know about quantity, it's not going to sound like it ought to. It's going to sound artificial. If you only scan it for accent, then you're going to find it, it's going to be there, but it's not really going to be the sound of the poetry. So when you're reading it with your eye, and you want to know if it's poetry or not, you can find the accents with your eye. You have to think about it, you have to reflect on it. But if you read the line out loud, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of imagination all compact. One sees more devils than vast hell can hold. That is the madman. That is the madman. It's dramatic. It's eloquent. The lover, all as frantic, sees Helen's beauty in a brow of Egypt. All he has to do is look at the map, and he sees Helen's beauty, because he's intoxicated with beauty. And even the map is beautiful. Everything is beautiful for the lover. He sees beauty in one face, and then he sees beauty everywhere. The poet's eye, in a fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from Helen to the map. He looks at both ends of the spectrum. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the secret essences of things, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. So where is the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothings a local habitation and a name. A local habitation and a name. A local habitation is a weighted phrase. A local habitation. It has a meaning. It's not a global general habitation where Egypt and the divine Helen are. It's right here in this form on the page. This local habitation. So a local habitation is not a local habitation. That's the difference in quantity and stress.
And so here you have also marked stress and long syllables at the same time, basically.
Okay, this is...
long syllables, stress, and...
Yeah. These are the stresses. These are the feet. Bite. Bite is which one? Bite. It's a very subtle I am. Alo, Kolha, Bitte, Shun and a name. This is iambic. So the iambic is at the very bottom, and then there's the stress, and then there's the quantity. Those are just different levels of structure, like genes, organs, cells, organs, functions, and personality. You know, they're just layers of the same thing. And at the top of that, where personality belongs in the human being, at the top of that is meaning for poetry. You know, there's the metric foot, and there's the stress, and there's the accent, and there's the quantity, and there's the meaning.
Is there also something like pause? For me, if I were to read it, a local habitation and a name.
Nonsense.
Okay. Explain why. I don't think
because it's mental. Because you're saying, I think there should be a pause here. It just suits my character better to have a pause here.
Okay.
And people really screw up poetry that way all the time. It's very normal. It's fine. Everyone does it. Because you read it silently. You're not thinking about the sound of it. You're thinking about the meaning of it. But you're thinking about your meaning of it, not the poet's meaning of it. And when people read Savitri, this is the surest way to twist Savitri's meaning completely out of shape.
By pause, there are no pauses.
By adding things like pauses, because there ain't no pauses. Except sometimes there's a dramatic pause. And when that dramatic pause comes in that rhythm, you know it because you can't move. It pins you. Because you're in the flow of the true poetry when you're reading it as poetry. If you're not reading it as poetry, if you're reading it as prose, and Savitri can easily be read as prose, and I call that sutra. You know, it's a teaching. But it has many levels. And the inspiration, we know, is coming from the overmind, and Sri Aurobindo is using rhythm to convey force. The force of the inspiration, which is... And sometimes he'll write 80 lines without even hardly a breath. It's like they just all flow, and nothing there is constructed. But you can't catch that if you're reading line by line. It's only if you're reading the whole 80 lines in a sweep that you realize what's there. And then suddenly all of those images array themselves, and that main meaning grabs you. And then you know that you're in touch with something.
Actually, there are poses. Like, for example, here's a comma. The forms of things unknown. The poet span turns them to shapes.
No. So you can, no, there's no pause there.
Yeah, I didn't make anywhere else pause, only where the comma is. So there is a legal pause. And there are poses when they are marked. Basically, pauses and caesuras are legal for caesuras, cadenzas, for...
But the kind of pause that he was talking about was a pause for meaning.
Yes.
That the pause should give meaning to the line. That you won't find.
Yeah, you charge it with your meaning.
But there are breaks in a poetic stanza. For example, between stanzas, there are breaks. And there, you pause. Definitely. So, for example, I'd like to read something at the end here. on page 377. This is a this is a poem called Descent. So here we see Sri Aurobindo writes at the bottom, these are sapphics. Sapphics are from the name Sappho. Sappho was a Greek poet.
337?
377. So Sappho wrote quatrains, very lyrical quatrains in Greek. And so this is a form which he has borrowed from Sappho, and he says, actually the four-line strophe is trochaic and dactylic. Each line is trochaic and dactylic. So you'll hear a troche and you'll hear a dactyl. Da, 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 da. You'll hear that. All my cells thrill, swept by a surge of splendor. Swept by a surge of splendor is the normal form, but all my cells thrill is an exception. He says, the second foot spondi is very usually replaced by a troche, the final troche sometimes by a spondi. An antibacchus can replace the dactyl. So the second foot spondi. First foot, all my cells thrill. Cells thrill is a spondi. Both words are extremely important. It's not all my cells thrill, all my cells thrill, all my cells thrill. It's all my cells thrill. So all my is this, all my cells thrill, troche spondi.
Then you have caesura after this year.
Then you have caesura, yes. Which is a difference in the middle. A different foot that's put in the middle is a caesura. And in the long hexameters, there are always caesuras in there. So that's what Sri Aurobindo, and he calls this experimental verse, and he says in the 15th line elision is used. In a sapphic line there can be only one dactyl. In a sapphic line there can be only one dactyl. So this is an extraordinary degree of technicality, but it's so familiar to him that he can do it and he can say it. He writes this in 1942. And he's the master poet. So he can look at any poem of his own or anyone else's and tell you where it belongs in this structural, in the structural possibilities of English. I don't think very many people can do that, frankly. And I don't think Sri Aurobindo probably could have done it in 1893. You know, this is the result of an extraordinary facility of language. So here, this poem goes like this. You can look at that one and I'll try reading it. Let's make it smaller so we can see most of it. Just reduce the size a little bit more. Okay, can you see that?
Yes.
That's not that much. Now let's see if we can just get four of these in there. Can you see that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's keep it like that. All my cells thrill, swept by a surge of splendor. Soul and body stir with a mighty rapture. Light and still more light like an ocean billows over me, round me. Rigid, stone-like, fixed like a hill or statue. Vast my body feels, and upbears the world's weight. Dire the large descent of the Godhead enters limbs that are mortal. Dire the large descent of the Godhead enters limbs that are mortal. Swiftly, swiftly crossing the golden spaces, knowledge leaps. Oh, sorry. So let me go back to the other one. Dire the large descent of the Godhead enters limbs that are mortal. Voiceless, thronged, infinity crowds upon me, presses down a glory of power eternal. Mind and heart grow one with the cosmic wideness. Stilled are Earth's murmurs. Swiftly, swiftly crossing the golden spaces, knowledge leaps, a torrent of rapid lightnings. Thoughts that left the ineffable's flaming mansions blaze in my spirit. Thoughts that left the ineffable's flaming mansions blaze in my spirit. Blaze in my spirit. Iambic spondee, it's exactly how he said the line would end. Slow the heartbeat's rhythm like a giant hammer's. Missioned voices drive to me from God's doorway words that live not save upon nature's summits. Words that live not save upon nature's summits. The essential thing there is words that live not save upon nature's summits. Only upon nature's summits. But only doesn't fit. It has to be one syllable. Words that live not save upon nature's summits, ecstasy's chariots. Ecstasy's chariots, two dactyls.
No pause after summit come up. Nature's summit.
You're really big on the pauses, huh?
I'm a grammarian.
Listen. Words that live not save upon nature's summits. Ecstasy's chariots. So it's an anapest. I mean, it's a what do you call it?